It has many names: Santa Ana, Scirocco, Chinook, and it beholds snow season, coming unbidden at high noon in summer or in the darkness of a winter's eve. The weather vane trembles and then suddenly pivots to point dead opposite. The white-capped ocean calms, waiting, as an oppressive blanket of air moves downslope and spreads over the two cities at the mouth of the river. Winter turns to summer, and summer becomes just a step away from hell's back door. The cooling fog flees seaward, fading like a ghost. Now the heat holds a small section of coastline in a firm grip. Heat and something else, the Chetco effect. Tonight's tale, Daciana, is a tale that's not for the faint of heart. So be warned, and remember, do be careful of those you might offend, because in the heat of the Chetco effect, anything is possible. Daciana danced alone at the edge of midnight. Her skin was supple and flawless. The dark tan of her gypsy ancestors now reflected crimson against the blaze from the fire in front of her. The hot wind and her body movements made her ebon hair ripple, creating a shimmering glow and framing her face in a faint halo. There was no music save her breathing and the waves that crashed against the rocks far below the cliff's edge. Whatever she was hearing was coming from deep within. Her bare feet scuffed a pattern into the dirt, and her arms made languid movements, synchronizing with the fluid dancing of her body. Back and forth she danced, almost to the edge of the cliff, and then back to the fire, never stopping, never breaking rhythm. No sense of fear, no need to look backwards at certain death from one misstep. Eyes a dark shade of steel were focused on eternity and revenge. She was dressed in sweat, a snake tattoo, and nothing else. Her movements increased subtly, her breath now coming faster. Her body a thin sheen of perspiration in the tattooed snake. A golden, detailed apparition that seemed almost alive in the flame's wavering reflection. Its body wrapped around her, starting at her left ankle, winding round and round until it reached her neck. Ending there, a golden, tightly scaled head resting beneath her chin, like a lover in repose. The flames roared up suddenly, turning a deeper red, shading to blue, and then a burst of harsh, actinic light. For a moment she appeared frozen, as though a strobe light had revealed her in the night, then dark again as she continued the dance unabated. The fire popped once and resumed its own dance of orange and red flames, writhing in a sudden gust of wind that sounded like some great hiss, then stillness. At the joint of her head and neck, the eyes of the snakehead slowly closed and then opened. It could have been an illusion created by the dancing flames, but it wasn't. Gradually, the head began to thicken and gain substance. At first, just a hint of dimension, and then round and pulsating, as scales moved and shimmered in the light. The eyes blinked once more as the tongue began to dart in and out of its mouth. A shadow formed against her neck as the head pulled back. It began to stretch away from her body, all the time swaying its head and body with the same rhythm as she. In an instant, it was no longer a tattoo. The dance faster now, and then faster still, becoming almost a frenzy. Now only her body moving as her feet planted themselves in one place. Faster and faster her body swayed, back and forth, an energetic, flowing rhythm. Black ophidian eyes locked with hers, and hers with them. The two of them moving together as one, connected by something both ancient and dark. Without warning, the dance stopped. Now there was only the sound of her labored breathing, the waves, and the popping of the fire. The snake began to leisurely glide from her body, long coils moving round and round, slowly unwinding, until most of its length was on the ground in front of her, moving away only to stop and look back as the last coil began to unclasp from around her waist, the last bit of it lingering briefly around the hint of a small bulge at her belly, the truth of the unborn child within and the seat of her rage, then dropping away as it gathered itself in front of her, raising its head to stare once more into her eyes. She reached out a hand and caressed the snake's head, and it bent beneath that touch. Moving forward, it laid its head against her cheek, as if returning to a safe haven. "Glycon," she whispered, and a tear mingled with her sweat. It blinked its eyes, and then slowly pulled away, rising up in front of her, staring once again into her eyes. The flickering flames played their shadows around them, a dying echo of the dance. She reached out once more and stroked the snake's head, and then dropped her hand to her belly and held it there. For a moment, her face softened, and the snake pulled back as if it might leave. Her head snapped up and her jaw tightened. "No," she said. "You must do my bidding." She stepped forward, anger and rage on her face. "He must pay." The snake did nothing. "He must pay," she screamed, and still it did nothing more than return her gaze. She stepped forward and slapped it hard. It pulled back and then, in a blur of speed, struck, burying its fangs deep into her throat. What might have been a shriek was reduced to nothing more than a gurgle. The force of the blow pushed her back to the edge of the cliff. Her body quivered once, as though she might start the dance all over, and then was still. She had time to run her hand down to caress her killer's head one last time, and then it released her. She smiled even as her eyes began to glaze over. Placing both hands gently over her stomach, she fell backwards into the darkness. It might have been a statue there at the edge of the cliff for as long as it stayed, eyes the color of obsidian, unreadable, and reflecting back nothing but darkness. Finally, the fire, now gone to embers, and the sun hinting on the horizon, it turned and moved away. In a moment it was gone, swallowed by the dense brush. The sound of its passage, a giant hiss of pain and rage. The embers popped once, as sparks rose up to join the fading stars. Richard Darius Covington III was bored. Not that there was ever much to do in this little grunt of a town. But now, since he had broken it off with Daisy, things had gone back to being completely dull. He grimaced, thinking about the last time he had seen her. How even then he had still wanted her, but knowing he had to cut her loose. Telling her it was her own damn fault, and that the kid probably wasn't even his anyway. That he could get five of his buddies to say that they had been with her. Sent her packing in no uncertain terms. Had to, or she'd have ruined his life. In the end, all he had been left with was the memory of her tears as she fled his anger. That, and how hollow he felt afterwards. Why his father had chosen to move to Brookings, Oregon was beyond him. He had never even heard of the damn place before they moved. Boston had been so much better. So much more to do. 3 years now he had lived here with his parents, and he had never forgiven them for it. 3 years of listening to people talk about fishing, hunting, logging, and whether or not it was a high tide, and then back to fishing again. It was enough to drive you insane. And here he was, sitting on the front porch, watching the time go past like some yokel. The only good thing, at least for the next week, was that he had the house to himself. The parents were gone, his father on a business trip, and his mother following like the trained seal she was. He swirled the scotch around in his glass and sneered, like he didn't know where the old man hid the liquor cabinet key, always treating him like he was a kid. He was sick of it, sick of this town, sick of the rain, sick of the smothering heat that came without warning. Like today, just another thing to hate about this place. You never knew if it was summer or winter. He leaned back in the chair and started to take another pull on the scotch and then stopped. There was a car coming up the road that went past the front of their property, or estate, as the old man liked to call it. Richard snorted. The old man had been a small partner in a large law firm in Boston. Out here, he ran his own practice. One other partner, and he was already calling it a firm. What a joke. He was nothing more than a big fish in a little pond. The car slowed and then turned into the long drive that led up to the house. Richard watched it and then casually eased the glass of scotch down behind the chair he was sitting in. He had had enough speeding tickets to recognize that vehicle. The county sheriff come to visit. Now why should that be? The old man had already taken care of the last ticket, called it entrapment or some such thing. Then had threatened him with taking away his keys if it happened one more time. Yeah, like that would happen. The car pulled up in front of the house, and Sheriff Sykes heaved his bulk out of the cruiser. He pulled off his hat and wiped the sweat off his brow. He looked around, started a little when he saw Richard sitting on the porch, and then walked up to the railing. He looked up at Richard, his face neutral. "Mr. Covington?" "Sheriff." They stared at each other for a moment, and then the sheriff shrugged. "I need to ask you about a young woman. Do you know a Daciana Arreri?" "Yeah, I think that's the way you say it. Arreri." Richard stood and looked down at the sheriff, liking the way the other man had to look up at him. He made no effort to keep the contempt out of his voice. "What do you want to know?" Sheriff Sykes looked up at Richard for a moment, face unreadable. He turned and walked over to the steps and up onto the porch. He walked over to stand in front of Richard, and now he was looking down at him. His voice was cool and without inflection. I don't think you understand how this works, Mr. Covington. I ask, and you answer. Richard blustered. My old man, Sykes held up his hand, is not here right now, so I'm talking to you. Once more, Daciana Arreri. Came in with that circus a few months ago in Crescent City. Was the talk of the town, what with her dancing with a live snake. Don't that beat all? Funny thing, though, they left and she stayed. Word on the street is she became infatuated with a young man. Maybe you, Mr. Covington. Do you know her? Richard's heart accelerated. Damn it. That bitch must have gone to the sheriff after he'd cut her off. This was bad, real bad. This time, the old man would really blow a gasket. Yeah, he finally responded, I think I know who she is. Sheriff Sykes smiled and took a step closer to Richard. Richard backed up without even thinking. Now again, word on the street, Mr. Covington, is that you and Miss Arreri were seeing quite a lot of each other. So I guess, son, before you start telling me half-truths and outright lies, you might want to consider what I already know. Look, Sheriff, a pleading note creeping into his voice, I don't know what she said about me, but I didn't do nothing with her. If she's pregnant, it's not my kid, it's someone else's. Pregnant, said the sheriff, and then nodded. I see. I believe you've got this wrong, Mr. Covington. Pregnancy's not my jurisdiction. Murder, on the other hand, is. She's dead. Richard took another step backwards, bumped into his chair, and sat down hard. Dead, he croaked. What happened? Well, that's what I came out to ask you, seeing as how you've been seen with her so much lately. And as a matter of fact, the coroner did say she was pregnant. Isn't that interesting that you would bring that up? Richard snapped his gaze up at the sheriff. Now wait just a damn minute, Sheriff. I'll admit I've been with her, but I didn't kill her. That's not something I would do. Sheriff Sykes looked down at him. No, Mr. Covington, truth is, I never thought it was. And I didn't come out here to accuse you of that. I just wanted to put some pieces of the puzzle together, and you've helped nicely. What do you mean? Coroner said it was either a suicide or death by, what did he call it? Misadventure. That's the word that piqued my curiosity. Misadventure. I just wanted to know why, and now I think I do. Poor girl got pregnant, and someone wasn't man enough to step up and do the right thing. That about the size of it, Ricky? Richard regained some of his composure. In fact, a sudden realization washed over him. This couldn't have turned out better. Everything coming up roses, as they say. It was a shame she was dead, and he did feel something about that. But relief was certainly the bigger emotion right now. Better still, it cured a rather nasty problem. And it's not like she'd been the first girl he'd turned away after he was done with them. Throwaways, his father called them, and Richard was beginning to believe that that was as good a word as any. He tried hard not to smile, at least not while the sheriff was still there. Well then, Sheriff, I guess if all your burning questions have been answered, you don't need to be here anymore. Sheriff Sykes stood looking down at Richard, and then abruptly turned on his heels and walked back to his cruiser. He stopped and looked back up at the porch, shading his eyes against the sun. So you don't want to know? Know what? How she died. Richard said nothing, just staring down at the sheriff across the porch rail. We fished her out of the ocean down by Lone Ranch. Of course, that's not what killed her. Go ahead, sneered Richard. Tell me it was a broken heart. The sheriff fought the urge to leap back up over the railing and beat some remorse into this arrogant young jerk. He shook his head and got into his car and looked out the window at Richard. A massive dose of snake venom, he said. Well, she did like her snake, said Richard, and this time he did smile. I think I have a better explanation, said the sheriff. Richard raised an eyebrow. I think, said the sheriff, staring hard at Richard, she added a bad snake to her act. One of those rare big city snakes. You know, the kind without any sort of backbone. By late afternoon, Richard was pretty well soused. I'm celebrating, he said, stumbling back to the liquor cabinet. He stared at it for a moment before opening the door. Of course, he said, chuckling, I'm in mourning, too. Now then, let's see, what's a good drink for a funeral? He eyed the scotch bottle, but it was getting too close to the point that the old man would notice there was some missing. Even drunk, he knew how to play this game. Had played it many times before. Reaching into the back, he pulled out a mostly full bottle of bourbon. There we go, he said. Scotland's bastard child, and splashed it into his glass, spilling some onto the floor at the same time. He looked at the wet spot drunkenly, shrugged, and then stumbled back out onto the porch. The sun was still a half an hour above the horizon, and a hot breeze was blowing across the city far below. It carried up to Richard, and then went still and oppressive. From this far above town, it was mostly quiet. He didn't like that. Didn't care for the silence at all. In Boston, there had always been noise. Even at night, the background noise of road traffic, people walking past and talking, doors opening and closing up and down the street. It was like music to his ears. Here, the silence was like an ice pick to the skull. Or maybe, he thought, it was the booze. To hell with it, he said, and knocked back the rest of his glass, and then looked at it with bleary eyes. A strong surge of sadness washed over him, some for Daciana, but mostly for all of the inequities that had been heaped upon him in his young life. "We should have stayed in Boston," he slurred. "Then I never would have met her." Suddenly angry, he threw the glass against the porch railing and watched with surprise as it passed between the rails. "Couldn't have done that sober," he said, and stood. Not quite stumbling, he moved to the rail. He was sweating buckets and undid the front of his shirt as he stood there, gazing stupidly at the sunset. "Gonna be a beauty," he sneered, echoing a phrase his mother was wont to say, and then frown. "Stupid cow, gave it all up for sunsets." Something moved at the corner of his vision, and he whipped around, thinking maybe the sheriff was sneaking up on him. His feet tangled, and he grabbed the rail to keep from falling over. The sudden movement made his head spin, and he felt his stomach do a hard flip-flop. Suddenly, he bent over the rail and threw up all the bourbon and a good portion of the scotch. Whatever had caught his attention was now forgotten in the retching that shook his body. Finally, he groaned and stood up, wiping at his mouth with the back of his hand. Suddenly, the idea of more bourbon or any alcohol seemed like the worst idea in the world. He went into the house and rinsed his mouth out at the kitchen sink. His stomach lurched, and he thought maybe he wasn't through, but it was a false alarm. He ran a glass of cool water and then stood for a moment at the sink. Taking a sip, not liking the way it went down his throat and landed hard in his stomach, he waited to see if that too would come back up. It didn't, but he waited, holding the cool glass against his forehead. Feeling only slightly better, he made his way back out to the porch. He stared at the chair, his alcohol-saturated mind having difficulty figuring out what its purpose might be. Finally, the synapses in his brain sluggishly fired the word chair, and he plopped back down in it, immediately leaning his head against the wall. Things began to spin, and he jerked his head up and stared instead out at the ocean. One lone tear traced its way down his cheek, and his breath hitched for a moment. "Daisy," he said, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean it." He sat that way for a long time, looking out the ocean as the sun dipped down and sank below the horizon, waiting as the sweat and the minutes pulled the alcohol from his body. A familiar routine and the worst part of drinking, but one that he knew would pass. Also knowing that before too many days had gone by, he'd be back at it again, having pushed this part of the experience to the back of his mind. "Not my first rodeo," he said. "No siree, not my first rodeo at all." As evening fell, he slowly began to recover. His stomach felt better, but his head was starting to pound. Now the pendulum of his emotions had swung back to anger and blame. "All her fault," he muttered. "All her fault." Something rustled through the hydrangeas at the side of the porch. Now steady, he stood and walked over to the railing. In the twilight, he could just make out the green of the plants and some of the blue flowers. The hydrangeas suddenly began to sway, and he jerked back. There was an odd sound, like something being pulled through the dirt. Cautiously, he leaned back over the railing. As he listened, the sound moved away from him and toward the back of the house, along with the movement of the plants against the siding. He swallowed hard. "Wind," he muttered. "Has to be the wind." Still, he suddenly felt very exposed out here on the porch and turned to go back into the house. Two steps and his foot connected with a forgotten glass of water sitting next to the chair, and went clattering across the porch, some of the water splashing up onto his pants leg. The sudden noise and the unexpected wetness against his leg shocked him. For just a second, the signals in his brain crossed, and he thought something had bitten him. He screamed. Jumping back, eyes wide and terrified, he searched the porch for what had attacked him. Then the glass fetched up against one of the rails, catching the light from the entryway, and he realized that was all it had ever been. He laughed, though it sounded hollow to him, and his footsteps made a rapid staccato as he crossed the porch and into the house. The door slammed, and in the still of the evening, the sound of the bolts being thrown could have been heard all the way down to the bottom of the property. Every light in the house was turned on. There was definitely something out there. Some wild animal of some kind. Maybe even a bear trying to get in. He had been hearing it ever since he had come back inside. A gentle sliding sound, like leather rubbing against the lap siding. And now and again, a thump, jarring and making him jump every time. He'd gone into the old man's bedroom and gotten his pistol. an old Army Colt 45 that the old man had brought back from the war. He held it now, comforted by its presence, even though he'd never fired a gun in his life. It was a false comfort. The safety was on, and there wasn't even a bullet loaded into the chamber. The moon had risen, painting the windows behind the closed curtains in autumn gold. It was hot in the house, and he longed to open a window but was too frightened. And the noise kept getting louder, as if other animals had joined into it. A loud, constant susurration that seemed to surround the house, raising and lowering in volume, but never stopping. Richard's head throbbed, and his heart was beating like a hummingbird's. His skin was a sheen of sweat, and he went from hot to cold in an instant, and then back. The nausea had returned, and twice he had gone to the sink with dry heaves. At times, as the noise increased, along with his heart rate, he felt the edges of his vision growing dim. If I faint, he thought, whatever it is will get in and kill me. And that made the noise in the darkness all the more terrifying. There was a hard thump, this time at the front door, and he gave a short, barking scream. Something moved past one of the windows, briefly outlining the moonlight, but too quick to make out, as if a branch had whipped in front of it during a windstorm, except that all was still outside, save the nerve-wracking sound. Another thump, another scream, and Richard leaped toward the phone. He didn't care. He was going to call the sheriff. Let the bastard make fun of him. Call him a coward. Call him anything he wanted to. He'd even admit that it was he that had gotten Daisy pregnant. Fess up to everything, anything at all, to get out of here and down to the safety of the town, even if it was just Brookings. He grabbed the phone out of the receiver and put it to his ear and started to dial. There was no dial tone, though through the earpiece there came another all-too-familiar sound, the same sound he had been hearing all evening, the gentle, brushing, leathery sound, and now abruptly overlaid by the sound of a busy signal, as if he had already dialed. No, 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 he wept, and turned the dial on his phone. Nothing, nothing save that god-awful noise. Now sobbing, he picked up the phone and threw it against the wall. It lay on the floor, adding to the sound outside. The insistent busy signal, a counterpoint to his own heartbeat. He yanked the cord from the wall to silence it. What is it? He screamed. What's out there? He stood there, shaking, tears falling onto his mother's brand new carpet. The sound continued, rising and falling, now sounding more like the breathing of some all-encompassing beast. There was a sudden electrical sound and then the smell of burnt wiring. The lights flickered and went out. In a frenzy, he ran toward the kitchen for the flashlight. He barked his shin against the coffee table and then went over it. He never even felt it and was up in a second and then into the kitchen. He almost wept when his hand closed on the flashlight and he flicked it on. He went back into the living room, standing there, shaking in the small pool of light from the flashlight. The sound never stopped and the thumps against the house were getting louder and more frequent. Now there were constant shadows moving past the drawn window shades, long, sinuous movements that made him think of the tattooed snake on Daisy's body, a thing that had, at one time, so intrigued and aroused him. Now it brought only a whimper of fear. Richard! It wasn't a real voice at all. Instead, it was a combination of the slithering and scraping against the house, forming itself into his name, and it began to repeat itself over and over. First one voice, then a chorus, and then overlapping. He held his hands to his ears, screaming, eyes shut, as if that would help silence the calling of his name. With horror, he realized the voice was coming from inside his head as well. I gotta get out of here, he whimpered. Gotta leave, gotta leave, gotta leave. He began to quietly inch toward the front door. His car was out there. It was his only chance. He turned off the flashlight and put it into his back pocket. The 45 was in his left hand. With his other, he pulled the keys from his pocket and held them tightly. Holding his breath, he slowly came up to the door, praying that he would be unheard. Carefully, he tucked the 45 into the front of his pants. He waited, listening to the sound, waiting for it to fade towards the back of the house, hoping that whatever was out there was something he could outrun to his car. Letting out his breath in one slow exhalation, he reached up and put his hand on the doorknob. The sound stopped. He stuffed the hand holding the keys in his mouth and bit on it to keep from screaming. His blood was warm and salty, and it flowed down his hand. The abrupt silence was more frightening than the noise, and he stood for long minutes thinking that his heart might burst in his chest, hoping even, because he was beginning to believe that a quick death was better than what was on the other side of that door. The phone rang. His scream tore at his throat. Behind him, the cord he had pulled from the wall began a slow and sinuous movement, reaching for him, but coming up short from the weight of the ringing phone. He sensed movement at his feet, From underneath the door, a small, wriggling snake moved towards his foot, small as a worm but flowing and slithering toward him. Then another and another, sliding beneath a small gap under the door. He couldn't move. He stared down, frozen in terror, the phone ringing and ringing, and still all he could do was watch as the reptiles moved closer and closer. One of them moved across his shoe and then began to inch up his sock, moving up his pants leg, and then a bite that tore his flesh, and he felt it begin to burrow underneath his skin. His throat was past screaming, a horrible wheezing gasp, and as the second snake crossed his foot, he jerked the door open and ran across the porch and down the steps. In the moonlight, the ground seemed to move in waves. As far as he could see, there were gliding, undulating snakes, and as he ran across them, they reached up and began to wrap themselves around his legs. The useless gun went flying from his hand. Panting, a constant moaning coming from him, he began to slow from a run to a walk, straining so hard that a vein burst just below his eye, now barely moving and now stopped as if planted to the ground, like a tree with dark, squirming roots, his car an impossible distance away. "Let me go," he screamed. "Oh, God, please let me go." In the distance, a sound on the gravel driveway, and for a moment his heart leaped, hoping it was a car. And there was something coming up the driveway, something large and golden, something that all the wriggling, slithering snakes were moving away from, parting to make a path. For a moment, he believed it was a car. Hope blossomed in his chest. Maybe it was the sheriff, come to ask more questions. Oh, God, yes, let it be the sheriff. Let it be anyone. As he watched, it moved closer, and in a moment, his eyes lit in recognition. Recognition and despair. "No," he whispered. "No. She's dead. You're supposed to be dead with her." It came up to him, massive and golden, slowing and then stopping, coiling up on itself as his head rose higher and higher to look down upon him. His gaze followed it upward, waiting for it to strike, but it did nothing, only staring at him. "I'm sorry," he sobbed. "I didn't mean it. I didn't mean it." It reared back, and he tensed for the blow, but it didn't come. "Please," he begged, "please let me go." Now it lowered its head down even with his and opened its mouth. Fetid breath washed over him, and then a long hiss that became raspy, whispering words. "You must pay," it said, and he knew that voice. "Please, Daisy, oh God, please, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry." "Not truly sorry," said the voice, "but soon, soon." The snake's mouth slammed shut, and a long tongue flicked out and began to touch here and there on his face. The snakes around his legs were constricting, and he moaned in agony and terror. The huge snake rose back up to his full height, glaring down at him. "Let me go," his voice weak. "Oh, please, let me go." There was a slight back-and-forth movement of its head, a denial, and then it turned and began a rasping glide down the driveway. As it did, it gave out an angry hiss that was echoed from all around him. Then it faded into golden moonlight, as if it had never been there at all. "No," he screamed, "no!" And then made only muffled sounds as the snakes completely enveloped him. And just before his mind snapped, he knew exactly what Daisiana's revenge was going to be. Richard Darius Covington III's mother was weeping when Sheriff Sykes came back to the house. She had been weeping the whole time he and the search party had scoured the wooded area around the house. She would weep long into the night and for many days thereafter. He never told her, or anyone else for that matter, what he found out there. He didn't want to believe it anyway. But he was an experienced woodsman, and he knew what he had seen out there in the forest. Human footprints leading up to it, but the undulating track of a huge snake leaving it. A dried husk of a thing that looked as if a human had shed its skin and then began to move along on its belly, like the snake that it was. The weather vane turns and a breeze cools the harbor. All is as it should be. Tonight's story, Daisiana, was written, produced, and read by Dan Gray. Music and sound effects by Zapsplat.com.